Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight on Movie Geeks United, writer-director Randall Miller talks about his new film, Bottle Shock. We talk about the second edition of the book, Setting Up Your Shots, with author Jeremy Vineyard. And the Movie Geeks will discuss their favorite shots and sequences from some of their favorite movies. It's going to be a great show tonight. Join in our chat room, call into the show, sit back and relax. Movie Geeks United is on the air. Geeks United. Hey out there, everybody. Glad to bring you the show tonight. This is going to be a fun one, I think. I'm joined here by Jerry. Hey, Jerry.
It should be a lot of fun tonight. It should be really cool.
I'm looking forward to it. And, of course, my name is Jamie. We have the chat room open, and Jerry's in there chatting away with everyone all the way through the show. It's a good time in there, so click chat available on the homepage, and it'll bring you right to it. And you can talk all about movies with other movie fanatics. You are not alone. There are others just like you. and they all joined there in the chat room. So how's everything been? You actually saw The Mummy this week.
I saw The Mummy, and, you know, I saw it midnight on Thursday, and by 2:05 when I left the theater, I had forgotten what I had seen.
Right.
So, you know, it's that kind of movie. But I had an awesome weekend, because I got to hang out with some friends who I used to work with at Borders, which is a large chunk of my life, and we had a great time. I hadn't seen them in 5 or 6 years, and I hung out with them for 2 nights. We went to a bar and a restaurant each night, and it was cool, because I missed talking about books and politics and things like that, and it was just a really good night. Really good night.
You know, they say that you attract the other people with the outlook that you have on life and your vibe.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard that reiterated on TV the other night, and I started thinking about my friends, and I was thinking, you know, I'm very lucky because I have friends that speak intelligently, just as you do, speak intelligently about all of those things and challenge each other and inspire each other. And I'm very fortunate the level of friends that I have, I think.
Yeah, no, I agree. It's very
There are only two of them, but...
No, you have more than that. I know you have more than that, just from the people I see in the chat room. And, you know, you have a lot of, actually, you know, Jamie has a lot of really good friends that do come in the chat room. Not every week, but they're in there enough to know that he's got some very loyal friends.
Thank you.
No, really, I mean, you do have some loyal friends who show up, so I that's awesome.
But that is a good weekend. I mean, that's the best weekend.
Yeah.
And I saw Swing Vote. We'll talk about that a little bit later.
Okay.
And maybe hear a little bit about more about Mummy if I can stand it.
Yeah, I didn't think I didn't want to really after yesterday's conversation. I really figured why bother.
Yeah, the big news is that The Dark Knight edged out The Mummy just by a hair. You know, Friday night it was looking like it wasn't going to happen, but we'll discuss that possibly a little bit later too, because this is a phenomenon that is inching up to Titanic.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's hitting the record books every week. But let's get started. I believe our first guest is here on the line, Randall Miller. He's a phenomenal writer director whose films include Marilyn Hotchkiss, Ballroom Dancing and Charm School, The Sixth Man, House Guest, and Nobel's Son. And his new film is titled Bottle Shock, and it stars Alan Rickman, Bill Pullman, and a host of other exceptional actors. It opens in limited release this Friday. It's a great pleasure to welcome to the show Mr. Randall Miller to tell us all about it. Mr. Miller, is that you?
Yeah, I'm right here. How you doing?
Hey, how are you, sir? Thanks so much for coming on the show.
Sure, no problem.
I'm very excited about this movie, and I definitely want to talk to you about it. I know we have limited time, but tell me first about your beginnings. I know that you attended USC.
Well, I went to the very beginning. I was pre-med, pre-vet at UC Davis, and I miserably failed at. And then I was an actor for a while, in commercials and whatnot, and then I went to USC Film School, and then after that I went to AFI because I didn't get enough film school, and then I started directing. The first big thing was 30-something I directed, and then after that I got a lot of other TV shows, and I directed some kind of fun movies, Class Act, A House Guest, some of those movies,
and I
moved on from there.
So, who are your early influences in terms of filmmakers?
Well, I mean, obviously, in terms of starting my career, Ed Zwick helped me, you know, immensely. But people that I, you know, love the work of, like this movie, I borrowed extensively from George Stevens, you know, from the movies Giant, some of the great, you know, those sort of movies, because I was going for sort of a widescreen feel, and
it looks that way from the trailer. It does.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, you know, the most beautiful place you could possibly imagine. You know, Napa and Sonoma are just absolutely stunning places. And you know, so often when you're making a movie or a TV show, you're always confined by the space. And you know, in this movie, it was all about how can I put people outside in this gorgeous, you know, locale. And that's what we're able to do here.
This is something that interests me. When you begin your filmmaking career, obviously you have influences. Is it a difficult process to step away from borrowing and find your own voice, or is it already there?
I mean, you know, you're I think Woody Allen or somebody said that, you know, the best form of flattery is theft or something. But
right.
You know, film is sort of like that. You know, you need to see a lot of movies and understand filmmaking to sort of understand what people have done before to sort of come up with your own ideas. It's such a collaborative form, and there's nothing really so unique in terms of filmmaking. It's all about the storytelling. It's all about, you know, what the characters you're telling, and you need to be, you know, you need to be versatile and know different types of filmmaking, but you really understand the form, you know, and once you do that, it's like anything. You get better as you do more. So
what stories are you attracted to, and how does Bottle Shock fit into that?
Well, Bottle Shock is just such an amazing story. You know, what I love about it is that it's a relatively small event, you know, individual event of the Spurrier, played by Alan Rickman, who's just phenomenal in the movie. He had this small idea, this, like, taste testing, which ended up having gigantic global repercussions in the world of wine. And so those are the kind of stories I love. I love stories where it's one small event, and you put it in the context of a movie, and it actually has a bigger import to it, you know. And I think that's what you can do in filmmaking. That's what I love movies, you know, that are about, like, something larger, that are just, you know, played on such a personal level. That's the key.
You've pretty much started to assemble a kind of a repertory company of actors here with Alan Rickman and Bill Pullman and Eliza Dushku. And does that kind of make the process obviously more pleasurable, but a lot more efficient when you're shooting a movie?
Yeah,
when
you know, it's so when you're making an independent film, you know, like this, and it's a labor of love for everyone, because, you know, you're telling. You know, you don't have the gigantic studio support that you might have, and where you're paying people a lot of money. It's all about everybody coming together as a team, you know, and we've had great luck where actors, knock on wood, seem to like us. Jody, my wife, is my partner, Jody Savin, and we work with Mary Steenburgen a few times. We worked with Danny DeVito a couple times, and a lot of the supporting cast. There's, like, Hal Klein was in a couple of the movies, and Mary Pat Gleason, and These are, like, great character actors, and I think that helps. You know, once you sort of assemble a team, you know, you do better. It's that way in sports. It's that way in so many things. And
absolutely.
You know, so I'm sort of a big proponent for that. And I have my DP. I want to talk to a little bit. Exposure. Who did it? you know, I just try to create like a real good family environment for everybody.
Yeah, and in terms of these actors, and you mentioned some terrific talents that you worked with several times. As a director, do you have to approach them each in different ways? Because each actor needs something different. Some want less talk, some want more talk. How are these actors different, how you've observed them, some of these
Well,
actors?
I mean, each, you know, they're all individuals with great bodies of work, you know. So, I mean, Alan is very specific in terms of the types of, you know, conversations we have about the character, about the role, you know, and Bill as well. Some of the actors, it's much more, you know, from the hip, you know. You know, some comedians are just from the hip, but it's all you know, you get to know them like you get to know anything. You know, they're very specific in their approaches to acting, and you know, and Alan is very detailed. He takes great care in every nuance, and we talk mm-hmm. about it, and we make notes, and Bill has you know, it's all about the story and about the about, you know, sort of the through line. So, you know, each person has a slightly different approach, but it's my job to sort of figure out how to, you know, how to use each person to their best, you know, and that's what
exactly.
I try to do.
Exactly. Yeah. Does wine or the process of making wine serve as a metaphor at all in this film?
Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, what's amazing about this film, I got to, when we decided to make the film, we met the Barretts, who the movie's about. It's a great true story about this, about these two guys, a father-son, who, you know, basically put it all on the line, risked everything to make a great handcrafted wine, you know, and they were successful in the end, you know, and that's Chris Pine's character and Bill Pullman's character. And it's much like Cody and myself. We, like, each time we go to make a movie, it's like a handcrafted movie. We, like, raise the money, you know, we find locations, we hire everybody. It's very similar, and that's what, you know, attracted us to the story, because it really is, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, you know, if we don't do it, it doesn't get done, you know, and that's a scary thing, but it's also incredibly rewarding when you finish it.
Yeah,
so.
I would imagine so. So Bottle Shock opens in limited release.
It opens this Wednesday. It actually opens this Wednesday.
Yeah, this Wednesday,
yeah.
August 6th.
Yeah.
Wow.
So
don't you have isn't Nobel Sun getting a fall release too?
That's coming out in October. October 3rd is the date right now. It may shift a week or two, but yeah, Bill Pullman's in that, and so's Alan and Eliza, and Eliza's just fantastic in that movie. She plays this crazy, you know, this crazy woman that's just fantastic. I don't want to give it away. And Alan plays a Nobel Prize-winning chemist who is just completely duplicitous and sleeping around in his grad students, and it's just a great, you know, great turn for him. So, I'm excited about that.
This is a huge season for you. So, how are you feeling inside that your two babies are seeing the light of day this season?
Yeah, it's just sort of this weird confluence of, like, they're so different. It's like Tom and Jerry, this one, you know, Bottle Shock is this gorgeous, lush movie, and Noble Son is like this in-your-face, you know, Lock, Stock, and Smoking Barrels. You know, Paul Oakenfold did the music. It's that kind of movie. So they couldn't be more different, and that's it's sort of exciting, and it's interesting when you talk to the press about it, they don't quite grasp it in the trailer, or they see the materials on Noble Son. They're just like, what? You did that movie too?
That's fantastic, though. You mentioned Woody Allen earlier, and Woody Allen, obviously, all his films are different, but he seems to be dealing with similar themes, and almost like he's working out something within the course of his career. And you can say the same thing possibly of Spielberg, where he works with similar themes each time out. But is versatility important to you as a director?
Well, you know, I really feel like, you know, you're only on this planet for a short period of time, and so you better take advantage of everything you possibly can do, right? So for me, it's like I want to try different things. I want to delve into different subjects. I mean, for me, it's this great learning thing. I get to learn about wine. I get to learn about, you know, Nobel Prize winning chemists. I get to learn about different things when I make a movie, and I find that really fascinating. I was always a good student, but I wasn't good enough to become a doctor. So this is sort of maybe my way to sort of make up for the fact that I wasn't good enough.
I know what you mean. So that's a very good outlook to have.
Yeah.
That's why we go to the movies, so we can learn all about life.
Yeah, I mean, you want to. I mean, what's great about Bottle Shock too is it's a movie where, you know, we all want to go to Napa, Sonoma, all those places, but I don't know if you really want to go like when I went, it was, you know, it was 110 degrees, you know, but it looks beautiful in the movie, and you go for 2 hours and you sit in your cozy,
you have the right idea,
and you know, it's fantastic. Yeah. So have some wine. It's a nice thing.
Well, I know you got. I know you got to run. Bottle Shock. It opens this Wednesday. And Mr. Miller, thanks so much for sharing the movie with us this evening. And you're welcome back on anytime you'd like.
Yeah, please come back.
All right. Thank you, guys.
Thank you,
all
Mr.
Right.
Miller.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. That's Randall Miller, writer-director of Bottle Shock. This Wednesday, great cast. Looks like a terrific movie. We spoke about it last week with Hal Klein.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very anxious to catch it.
I think this will be the sleeper of the end of the summer. I really do. I think this is going to be on a – I mean, the reviews have been very good so far, and the trailer's great. It's got a great cast. It looks like, you know, it's a winner as far as I can tell right now.
I think so. And he had limited time. He can only spend about 10, 15 minutes with us. That explains why we ended the interview so quickly.
Yeah, because he's all over the place. This thing is Wednesday, and he is all over the place. So
it's like a speed interview. It's like speed dating. It's only, you don't get lucky at the end of it.
Yeah. Okay.
So
not the analogy I would have used, but no, I
understand
where you're coming from.
It's
a good one. I like it.
Thank you. Appreciate that. Mummy, Forgetful, is it entertaining? Is it fun fluff as you're watching it?
I told you this a while ago after the disappointment of the last Indiana Jones things. There are some movies I wouldn't even think about, give second thought to. I was like, well, maybe they might actually be pretty good. And The Mummy was one of them with the trailers I was seeing. I'm watching it, and I'm just like, you know, this is, the beginning, the prologue, if you will, that tells us like the origin of the story of and by the way, the review I wrote, my editor had to send me a thing, Jerry, you have to change it. It's not Golden Emperor, it's Dragon Emperor. That tells you how much of an impact this film had on me. I didn't even remember the title. So that was this commotion this morning. But it's just after this exciting prologue with Jet Li and Michelle Yu, it's just not much of anything. And I have to say, as much as I like Maria Bella and she's a great actress, she's trying so hard to be Rachel Weisz. That's jarring, and it reminded me so much of The Kingdom of the Crystal Skull. You know, it takes place after World War II. There's a father and son dynamic. And you're having a hard time accepting the fact that Luke Ford is Brendan Fraser's son, because I think there's only a 13-year difference between the two of them, and that's a problem right there. But it's not even fun. It's just kind of it's very forgettable. But it's there's nothing really there, sadly.
Yeah, I've never been a big fan. I know people that are huge fans of the Mummy series. You know, I it's just a kind of genre that I don't gravitate towards in the first place. So I'm not the fairest judge of it. But you spoke of trying too hard.
It does. I think it really does.
I think that explains Swing Vote, which I saw this weekend.
Oh.
Yes. Oh.
Let's hear. But I want to hear about
You know, I am one that actually I like Costner very much in comedies, and I think I've spoken to this before. I think he has a very effortless, natural charm that comedies utilize very well, and in dramas it's a different story. I think he's just a brooding kind of. There's really no color in the dramatic performances I've seen him in, other than possibly JFK, but I think Oliver Stone is the one that adds all the color to that.
I think it's really Oliver Stone's film. He's the real star of that film.
Right. It's Oliver Stone's Godfather.
Yeah.
But I really like him in comedies. Tin Cup, you know, it looks just like I said, a natural charm. In Swing Vote, I think the first and foremost, the problem that I saw and what was so off-putting about it was he seems to be trying so hard. It's almost like an over-the-top kind of performance. He's playing something similar to Tin Cup, you know, a washed-up, kind of drunkard, irresponsible adult, you know, that needs to grow up and take account of his life. But I equate it with the performance Dennis Quaid gave in Great Balls of Fire, which I actually like Great Balls of Fire, but it's directed to be kind of a cartoon in a way, you know.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So the performance doesn't really stick out like a sore thumb, and this one it really does. another problem I have with Coster films a lot of times, even the ones I love, like Open Range, there tends to be such kind of like a heavy-handedness about it, where everything out of his mouth has to be so profound. You know, and I had a problem with that in Open Range, because I prefer the cowboys that are the strong, silent type, you know, not the ones that are, you know, turn around and they're poets all of a sudden.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But everyone else in the movie does this for him here in Swing Vote. There's some funny moments in it. You've heard about the mock political ads. That's
right.
Very humorous, how the candidates will flip-flop just to get this one vote and go against what they believe in.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, I mean, it's hokey and corny, and I can accept that because I know they're going for Capra-esque. And but for me, the movie works at the exact place where all the critics are saying that it flounders.
Okay.
And that's when it's a single parent home. Kevin Costner's raising his daughter, who is the highlight of the movie, the girl that plays the daughter. I know she doesn't exist in real life, this character, because she's too good to be true. But she is absolutely wonderful and elevates the movie so much. She goes to see her mother that estranged her. And I've read specifics about this in reviews that say it's completely wrong tonally. It comes out of nowhere. For me, it didn't. For me, the movie was building up to that from the first
right.
scene.
Okay.
And it provides the most honest moment in the entire movie, because she's quite a mess. Look for the scene in the movie where she tells her mother that she'll take care of her, and it broke my heart. And in the middle of this movie that was a mess and wasn't very effective for me at all, that little human moment just,
mm-hmm.
You know, I walked away with something from the film because
right.
of that moment. And the ending works. I mean, all of a sudden he's washed up and he's politically conscious. He spends a night studying all about politics and the issues. And, you know, in 12 hours, he's all of a sudden this incredibly informed citizen. So,
right, right.
You know, it takes a leap of faith, like most movies, but it's hit and miss, really hit and miss. But it does have some moments that it's hard not to like.
How does it compare? A couple of years ago, there was the Robin Williams movie Man of the Year or something. How does it compare to that one?
Yeah. You know, I'd actually read that who was originally supposed to do Man of the Year?
Who was?
Howard Stern. It was written for Howard Stern.
Oh, my, that would have been very different.
It would have been way different, and it probably still wouldn't have been a very effective movie. But
No, it probably wouldn't.
You know, I don't know. The political comedy is it had a great premise for me, Man of the Year, and then it kind of went off course with the voting, and all of a sudden the voting fraud became the main focus of the movie, and it felt like two different kinds of planes that you were trying to navigate.
Right.
It's probably exactly like Man of the Year. I'd probably place it in terms of its effectiveness and its structure and in the same boat as Man of the Year. It's, you know, I think they're equally messy.
Right. Okay. Yeah. Just this one. You know, from what I'm hearing from you and what we have Deborah in our chat room, who's a friend of ours on MySpace. You know, it's actually not a funny movie, Swing Vote.
It wants to be. It really wants to be. And you're right, teacher in the chat room. Wag the Dog is a great political movie.
But that's
probably
that's notches above these two. I mean,
it's probably the last great political movie if you don't count Dark Knight.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right.
You were. I have a 301 area code here. The caller that you're talking about, is she from your area code?
Is she, or it could be someone we've had on the show before. So I think it might be Francis, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay, let me see. 3-1 area code, go right ahead.
Hey guys, it's Francis. How you doing?
Hey Francis.
Hey buddy, what's going on, bud?
Hey, I just wanted to call up here. We're 4 days out from the screening of Boxing Day at the AFI Silver Theater. I wanted to get another plug in to remind
you.
Go ahead, my friend.
Thank you. It's this Thursday, August 7th at 9 p.m. at the AFI Silver Theater in Silver Spring, Maryland. You can go to our site, www.boxingdaymovie.com. And even if you're not in the area, if you know somebody who is in the area, go ahead and tell them, because we're trying to get as many people as we can out to see this movie. It's a beautiful theater. The AFI, of course, the American Film Institute, that's their kind of premier place on the East Coast. They do Silver Dock there, and it's a great facility. So, and it's a great movie, too. So it's a win-win.
Yeah, it is, on all counts.
When are the nerves popping up for you, man? Are you relatively calm now, or are you going to start getting nervous like a couple hours before, or what?
I've been nervous for about 2 weeks. it's going to be one heck of a release on Friday, I'll tell you that.
I can imagine.
I think, you know, at the risk of discussing your viewers, I may have vomited my own body weight by the time we get to Thursday, so we'll see.
Well, I need to lose some weight. I think I should make a movie.
Yeah, that's
right. Yeah, exactly.
That will do it.
The filmmaker diet. Yeah,
it's better than crack making a movie for weight loss.
It does. I'll tell you what. There's something to that because you know when you're working really fast, you just stop eating. And like look at Peter Jackson when he made King Kong. You know,
he is no longer the size of King Kong. Yeah.
So there you
all
go.
Right, buddy. So this Thursday.
That's right. This Thursday, 9 p.m., AFI Silver Theater in Silver Spring, Maryland.
All right, cool. I'll be
there. We're cheering you on, buddy. And please call us back and tell us how the screening went, some highlights from the experience.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
All right, man.
All right.
Cool. All right,
thank you, buddy.
Francis. Have a good one.
You too.
That's Francis Abbey. We spoke to him a couple of weeks ago. His new independent film, Boxing Day.
Right.
It was Thursday at AFI Silver Springs, Maryland.
Silver Spring, Maryland. Silver Spring,
Maryland. It's a nice theater.
It's a
nice theater, Jerry.
You've
been there?
Oh, I've been there a lot of times. It's very nice. Who would ever thought that the AFI would come to Silver Spring, Maryland? That was just one. I know I shouldn't say that, but yeah, I was shocked. We have AFI, and then we have the Discovery Building right across the street. So it's
we have nothing like this here. I mean, we have actually here, and here is Podunk, Florida. We have two classic theaters nearby, one down the street from me and one in Tampa, that are still open, and they're just the huge movie houses from the, from the 1940s or 30s.
Right.
Gorgeous, gorgeous building, and you know, they're constantly having fundraisers so they can keep up the place and, you know, keep it going.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the one here in town down the street from me, my father has stories. He's lived here all of his life. He went to see Elvis there in the 50s. They used to have live concerts there.
Oh, that's awesome. That's
isn't
great.
It? I mean, and they're so valuable to a community. I mean, they're history. And it just takes you back as soon as you walk in, and it's so ornate and elegantly designed, and there's just a feeling and just the smell of it. It really takes you back when you walk in those doors, like you're walking into the past somehow.
No, you're absolutely right.
Yeah, it's just
absolutely a
magical experience, and but I've yet to go to one where I've been able to hear anything that's going on screen. The sounds, they're so massive. The sound system, the sound systems are always kind of lacking to watch a movie in those places. But you know, what are you gonna do?
Yeah, that's right. No, I mean, I agree with you 100%. We don't have. I mean, this theater, they refurnished it. I believe it was the old Silver Spring Flower Theater from a long time ago, but we had a lot of great revival houses around here, as I've taught, with the Circle Theater, the Biograph, the Key, that have all gone away.
What I wouldn't give to live, I don't know if these movie theaters still exist, but to live close to a revival house that
mm-hmm.
brings in Kurosawa or Bergman, you know, let's watch a Bergman film this week. You know, it's not a great date movie, I guess, but...
Right. No, but we AFI
watch
that.
A Bergman film this year.
Yeah, it's AFI does that. Their programming reminds me a lot of the Lincoln Center in New York. You know, they'll have those retrospectives, and the same with another great revival house is actually in Los Angeles, the Beverly Cinema.
Yeah,
they have these
yeah.
awesome double features, just incredible.
Yeah, and you know, it, we spoke to this last year on one of our shows. It's dying. College kids used to be able to go to the cinema, to a revival house down the street, and watch the latest foreign films or, you know, other kinds of films. And sadly, it's gone. You know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think our culture has suffered because of it.
I think you're right. But I guess it's also because it's the technology, it's the DVD, and
right.
it's that too. But I don't. Yeah, you're right. I mean, it does. There was a time. I mean, look, my mom took us to see all these French movies one summer at the Circle Theater. This is like 25 years ago. and it was incredible. And you don't, you can't do that now.
But I DVD has helped out because, you know, companies like the Criterion Collection, they've made these available for the masses, you know, so some of these films are have a chance to be seen for these new generations.
They're very helpful.
Yeah, but you watch them in the isolation of your home, you know,
mm-hmm.
there's no kind of communal experience or communal sense of discovery when you know, that's what I miss. I miss that sense of community in the movie theater to begin with. I mean,
yeah.
you sense it in a horror movie or a comedy, but...
Yeah. When I lived down in Los Angeles, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art, they had this revival series, and they showed HUD, Advise and Consent, a lot of foreign films, and they were packed. They did a Samuel Fuller movie one night where his widow introduced the film. It was,
That's beautiful.
40 Guns, I want to say was the name of the movie. I'm not positive, but she autographed his memoirs for me.
That's beautiful.
And but it was these things were crowded. There were lines to get into these.
It's an event.
Incredible.
Yeah.
Especially
yeah.
for HUD. It was amazing.
Well, I love HUD.
That's an awesome movie.
HUD.
HUD. That's just an awesome film.
Our next guest is on the line, and I'm very excited about this segment, and he's been waiting patiently. But
okay.
let me just say, when I spoke about Kevin Costner earlier, and how he speaks so profoundly in his Westerns and in most of his movies, you know, he's just so articulate and profound. HUD. Look at HUD. That's how that role should be played, you know.
That's right. This absolutely.
Strong, silent, you know. It's there's power in that. All right, our next guest is here. The second edition of the very popular book, Setting Up Your Shots, has just been released, and this is an invaluable breakdown of the methods filmmakers use to communicate visually. Laid out in a horizontal format, author Jeremy Vineyard and illustrator Jose Cruz run through the gamut of camera moves from the simplest pans and tilts to the most complex crane and dolly shots. This is an essential and really fun read for any fan of film, whether you want to be a filmmaker or not. It's just it's a lot of fun to look through. And it is our great pleasure to welcome the author of this book, Mr. Jeremy Vineyard, to our program.
Yeah,
Jeremy,
hey,
are you
how
with
you
us?
Doing? You guys can hear me, right?
I can hear you great. Thanks for being on.
Sure.
I love the book, first of all, and I can't wait to discuss it with you.
Sure.
When did your love affair for film start?
You know, the funny thing is I didn't really, you know, wasn't really interested in filmmaking until probably about the mid-90s, and I started hearing about guys like Robert Rodriguez and Kevin Smith and, you know, Tarantino and all these guys who are all making these really, really low-budget movies
yeah.
and being really successful at it. And I was like, oh, this will be easy, you know. All I got to do is go to L.A. and write a low-budget movie, and I'll be just as successful. And it turns out that it's a lot harder than that. It's
much harder.
Really, more complicated than I ever imagined it would be just to get one, you know, movie made. But, yeah, I mean, basically the mid-90s, I just started reading about guys like Robert Rodriguez, and I was like, well, that sounds like something I'd like to do for a living. So
yeah.
I got a job in L.A., and I didn't have the money for film school. I don't come from money. My parents don't have any money, and so I'm like, well, you know, all the kids with money, they can go to USC or UCLA, and I'll
right.
never be able to do that. So I've got to come up with an alternative methodology.
Join the club, man.
Yeah, I know. Welcome to the family.
Yeah, the best way to learn something is to learn something and then eventually get paid for what you've learned. And the best way to do that, I think, is to write something about it. Because that way you get, you know, a little bit of royalties. It's not a lot, but it's something, and it certainly makes the effort a little more worthwhile if you can share
mm-hmm.
with people and get some royalties. So, yeah.
So when did this idea first strike you to write a book of this nature?
Well, my background originally is an engineer. I used to be a software engineer. And so my background is in breaking things down and studying them piece by piece.
Mm.
And that's kind of how, what I was originally planning to do was be like a game designer or a game programmer. And it's like, oh, that would be really cool to do for a living. And then I kind of figured out that game programmers don't really have a great life. They pretty much work 100 hours a week in front of a desk, and that's their life. You know, it seems like it would be really glamorous to be a game designer, but it's not. You know, you just sit in front of a desk for 100 hours a week, and nobody knows who you are. And I was like, oh, I'm not going to go this way. So I'm going to try something else and do something creative where I actually get to interact with people And filmmaking is great because you're constantly interacting with people, whether it's a positive thing or a negative thing. At least you're interacting with people. And I just was like, how do I learn from scratch to make films? I've never studied filmmaking before. I'm not the kind of kid that grew up making short films. I got to learn as much as I can, as quickly as I can. How do I do that? And so I just started renting every movie I could possibly rent and trying to study as much as I could possibly study and learn as much as I could possibly learn. And I've tried to share that with people. And, you know, there's a lot of criticism. There's some criticism from people who say, well, it's too simplistic. But you've got to understand that from my perspective, starting out from scratch, knowing absolutely nothing about film or absolutely nothing
right.
about cinema, for me,
how is it simplistic?
So,
how
I wrote
so?
It.
Yeah, how is it? How is it considered? I know that you're breaking down all the kinds of different shots in films,
yeah.
And that's the function of the book. Are people
right,
saying?
Right. Well, there has been some complaints on the internet that it's too simplistic, but it just kind of, you know, to me, I would rather have a book that I can just quickly browse through than a book where I have to read it for like 6 hours just to get one,
right.
you know, scrap of information. That's just me. Is I prefer brevity, and you know, with the second edition, we've tried to
keep
add more information, but still, it's still, you know, something you can browse through, and you don't have to sit there for, you know, 6 hours trying to find one little scrap of information in six chapters. They're just completely chock full of, you know, text and discussions and all that stuff. So for me personally, it's something that you can just really get into really quickly, and that's the appeal of it, and that's why I wrote it. So.
Yeah.
You know, it's definitely good for new filmmakers, and you know, Spielberg isn't going to need a book like that. But if you're starting out, you know, and you need to know how stuff works and what the mechanics of everything is, I think it's a starting point. So,
well that's very good that you've done that because I mean, keep it simple. It shouldn't be especially for the first time, the beginning filmmaker. It shouldn't be so complicated. It should be something very accessible.
Right. Well, that's what I think. Yeah, that's my thing.
And you do include examples of films, and in each shot that you list here, examples of films that utilized that shot, you know, and when you do that, it gives you an example of how these shots can be motivated,
right?
Because you know there's a lot of directors now who use really cool techniques and cool shots and sequences, but they're really just showing off. It's nothing to do with the film,
you know. Yeah, you know, and I just think it's useful information. The examples, it's just, what I notice when I'm watching a lot of movies is there's only a limited number of ways you can move the camera, you know. You can move the camera up, you can move it down, you can move it left, you can move it right, and so there has to be some kind of language. Why did he move it in? You know, there's a very common effect you see in movies all the time, which
mm-hmm.
is the camera dollies forward to a character, right? You know,
mm-hmm.
it's like a medium wide shot, and you dolly forward to a close up of the character, and it's very dramatic. You know, it's a very dramatic shot, and you see it hundreds, if not thousands, of movies. But what is the language? What does that mean when somebody does that, when they push into a character on the screen?
Right.
Or they pull out to reveal additional information that we haven't seen before? You know, there's a difference between pulling back from somebody to give them distance versus pulling back to reveal additional information. So there's. Yeah, yes, you're moving the camera back in both contexts, but there's a different meaning behind it, a different reason for doing it. That's what I wanted to try to figure out, why do filmmakers do this, and what is the language behind it? So that's the general idea.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you how long was this process when you as you were watching films? How many films did you watch roughly to study?
You know, probably hundreds, if not thousands. I just try to pick a good sample from every major filmmaker, everybody from Bergman to Oliver Stone to, if you notice, the difference between the first one and the second one is a lot more Bergman movies, just because I went through this like Bergman phase last year. I was watching all these Bergman movies. All right, I got to have every Bergman movie reference in there because he's such a great filmmaker. But yeah, I mean, I just sat down, I tried to get a good cross-section of old movies and new movies and, you know, everything from The Matrix to, you know, movies that people may have never seen, and then maybe they go and pick this up on DVD, and they've never bothered to see some classic film, some, you know, Scorsese film. They've never seen Raging Bull. I'm sure a lot of film students these days probably have never seen, you know, a lot of these classic movies, all of Raging Bull, or, you know, which is kind of sad, but you think about
it,
they're probably watching, like, The Matrix and, you know, The Rock and stuff like that. So, Yeah, but yeah, I just hundreds, probably thousands of films over the years, and I keep notes. Every time I watch a movie, I keep notes. I'm pretty studious about it. So I'm constantly, you know, that's where the second edition comes in. That's the notes that I took from watching hundreds of movies between the first edition and the second edition. You know, it's kind of a pain in the ass, but, you know, as I watch a movie, I'm trying to become a better filmmaker, so I study it and I take notes and I keep those in a computer file, and voila, that's the second edition, you know?
Yeah, what do you have a favorite kind of camera move?
You know, if I had to pick one, I have to say it's like the effect that people do all the time, which is where you're looking down at somebody and you're spinning. It's one of those effects. Mm. It's like there's these things that hundreds of people do. You know, hundreds of filmmakers have done this.
Right.
And I don't know if everybody thinks it's unique or whatnot, but there's that one effect. You know how you're looking down at somebody and they're sleeping and the camera spins, or they're knocked unconscious and the camera spins. You've seen that before, right?
Right.
And there's also the one that I like where somebody is frustrated or angry or they're surprised or they have some great revelatory moment, and the camera does is it cranes up, right, this revelatory moment, which is what I call the crane up expression, which is like, you know, in a movie where this guy has some great revelatory moment and then the camera cranes up above him as to sort of express his inner emotions kind of thing. So there's a lot of things you can do with a camera that really add a lot to the movie. You know, there's like if you watch Bound, have you ever seen Bound?
That's a great film, yes.
Yeah, the way that those guys move the camera is just amazing, man. I've seen that film two or three times, and those guys, they don't just set the camera up and shoot like a master shot. The camera's like a living, breathing thing for the whole movie. It's like, the Coen brothers do that too, so.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, I would just say, you know, I came to L.A. and I thought it would be a hell of a lot easier to make an independent film, and it turns out it's virtually impossible, you know.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know if you guys have heard, but.
It's the hardest business to break into.
Yeah, well, I don't know if you guys have heard, but virtually every independent filmmaking company on the planet is going out of business now.
We know. We
you know, like Picture House went out of business, Paramount Vantage out of business, WIP, Warner Independent, for the non-industry folks out of business, Capitol Films bankrupt, you know. It's like every independent filmmaking company used to make these really great, like, you know, There Will Be Blood type movies.
Yeah, no, they're
all going out of business, and it's like, what do you do now? So that's what I'm kind of struggling with. It's hard. It's really hard to find financing for anything that's unique or interesting. So
the studios are having trouble too.
It's
not just, I mean, the little guys, and because of, but also the studios. There's a lot of financing deals because of the hedge funds have gone bust.
Right.
It's horrible out there.
Yeah, I know, and I think that's what a lot of filmmakers don't realize is they read about guys like Tarantino, and they're like, oh, all I did was he wrote a little script and he got Harvey Keitel on board and he got the money and it was easy.
No, it worked, though. That's what they don't understand.
Yeah,
it
I know.
It worked.
And
it's hard to find an industry that isn't suffering now except the oil business.
the oil business is the only thing. I mean,
that's probably a good place to go to get some film investors. But yeah, I mean,
you're right.
I mean, they're like Academy Award-winning producers and Academy Award-nominated producers, and they have Academy Award-winning actors attached to their film to star in the movie. They can't get the movie financed. And then they had this one. Did you hear about this movie called Death Defying Acts? With it had Guy Pearce and Catherine Zeta-Jones in it.
Yeah.
Well, it's called Death Defying Acts. It was about Harry Houdini, starring Guy Pearce and Catherine Zeta-Jones,
right,
which is the biggest movie stars in the world. It opened in like 4 theaters and it made like 10 grand. And that's how bad the business is right now. You got two of the biggest movie stars in the world, and the studio, the Weinstein Company, couldn't even afford to open it up in more than 4 theaters and made like $10,000.
Yeah,
I think, you know, Jerry and I were talking about this earlier. I think that's the true litmus test. And we talked about, you know, 10, 15 years ago when Weinstein basically brought about a resurgence, if not invented, the whole independent film craze. And now look at Mr. Weinstein, and he can't, you know, he's unable to work in this climate. He's unable to get anything going.
Yeah, I know. I mean, he's had to struggle for years. I think there was a Rob Marshall film that he couldn't get going for years, and he can't even finance Tarantino. I mean, Tarantino is like his star, man.
Yeah, and Universal finally picked up Inglourious Basterds.
Right, and he didn't even finance the movies for his own star. Like, Sin City was a huge, huge hit for those guys. It made truckloads of money, and they're not making a sequel to Sin City 2, I don't understand why, because that thing has made so much money for them, man.
Remember Orion?
Yeah, I'm not that. I'm sort of young for that, but I kind of vaguely.
Silence of the Lambs.
Well, yeah, well, they had two best winner pictures.
Yeah, yeah.
2 years in a row, Dances
yeah.
Wolves and Silence of the Lambs. They went belly up right after Silence of the
yeah,
Lambs.
Yeah, I mean,
it's tough. It's tough on the. You know, there are two schools of thought in terms of directing. There's those that their cameras are basically just stable and unobtrusive, and there's those that treat the camera as another character in the film.
Right.
You know,
Sales versus
yeah.
the Coen Brothers.
Yeah, Coen Brothers, Scorsese, Stone. I would probably put Spike Lee there too.
Mm-hmm.
Which one do you which method do you prefer?
You know, I just love the way that the Coen Brothers shoot a movie. If you look at any of the Coen Brothers movies, every time something happens, the camera is alive. It's like a living creature. There's never a moment in a Coen Brothers movie where it's just two people talking. Well, I mean, there are, but there's always something going on. Like if you watch the scene in the bowling alley, and he lifts his hand up, and the camera pans up to his hand in the air, and then swish pans right, and it pushes in, and it cuts to the guy in the watching the bowling, and then, you know, it's like it's very interactive, it's very fun, and it's very fluid, and you know, I just think that's more fun to watch personally. And you know, Scorsese, yeah, another example of a guy who's so talented, and yet he's sort of at the point now he's reverted to doing remakes, you know, which is kind of sad. I find that kind of sad, but. What can you do? You know, he's doing The Departed, which he won an award for, but it's, I don't know. It's one of those things where you're kind of like, yeah, right, The Departed? Like, he didn't win Raging Bull, and he won for The Departed? Yeah, okay, it's kind of bullshit, but all right. But it's just, that's what I've, you know, as far as the camera movements go, I think guys like the Wachowski brothers and the Coen brothers and Scorsese, those are the guys that are doing things that are cinematic and interesting, and Baz Luhrmann, you know, if you like... Pulls. I don't know if you like the Moulin Rouge movie, but he's very fluid with his camera, and he creates the cinema.
Yeah.
And that's a big difference, I think, between, like, I tried to watch that Chronicles of Narnia movie.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I tried to watch that movie. It bored me to tears.
Oh, I think you got to be into the source material to really...
I don't know.
They were better, especially the second one was kind of better than I thought it would be.
I haven't seen the second one yet.
Yeah, but no, let me say, you're absolutely right. I mean, if that's not your cup of tea, if you don't like Lord of the Rings, first of all, Narnia, you're gonna be pulling your hair out, you're gonna be picking your nails. I mean,
Well, I'm just saying in terms of the sort of camera in Chronicles of Narnia, it was almost shot very still and very.
Oh yeah, he left it. I don't think he moved it at all.
Yeah, and so it was kind of just something cinematic in that movie.
Yeah.
Have like the lion running across a field and the camera's tracking him and you crane up behind the lion or something, you know, do something interesting. That's what I think about Peter Jackson did really well is he created a spectacle out of Lord of the Rings.
Oh, he did.
Chronicles of Narnia, it's like a bunch of people sitting around talking and a lion shows up and you're just like, oh, please kill me now.
It's a bunch of talking roadkill. roadkill, okay? You got a talking beaver in the film, okay? I mean...
Yeah, I just wasn't my cup of tea, you know.
Yeah.
Filmmakers who know how to really move the camera and really set things up, it's, you know, it's a great experience when you're, you know, even if it's 3D, like the Beowulf movie, I thought it was pretty good, the 3D. Did you see the Beowulf movie in 3D?
I didn't see it in 3D, but I did see it.
I think it's probably a lot better in 3D, but I saw the 3D version. It was a lot of fun, but, you know, I don't know if that's where it's going. I don't know if it's all going to be CG and 3D in the future, but... But, yeah, it's really, 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 really brutal because everybody wants to be a screenwriter. Everybody wants to be a filmmaker.
Yeah.
And as far as, like, I've been trying to get this little independent movie made for years now. And it's like
Concrete Road.
Yeah, I got Keith David. Attached, you know who Keith David is?
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
He's a great actor, but he's not really considered to be a name actor, which is what you need to get the money. And I've been going to all these different producers and, like, yeah, I get lost, and then the next producer, yeah, screw you, and the next, you know, the next actor and the actors. You know, it's amazing because actors, to me, are really just, they don't care about the material. I mean, they say they do, but when you meet an actor and they say, wow, this is amazing material, this is the best role I've read in years, I love the character, and you're like, great, will you help me? Will you call somebody? Will you make an effort to maybe... get one of your friends attached who's also an actor, it could be really valuable to get the financing, and they're like, no, screw you, get lost. I ain't lifting a finger to help you, man. And that's what's so frustrating about it, is you read about, like, Harvey Keitel helps Tarantino out, he produces his movie, and he opens all these doors for him, and I've never met an actor who would do anything to help me, even if they like the material. They're always like, wow, you're a really good writer, but screw you.
Well, that's Jeremy, that's
yeah.
I've known this for a long time. The business is all, not always, but I would say for a good chunk of the 20th century at least and into the 21st, this is nothing new. The business has always been this dog-eat-dog, very cutthroat.
Right.
This is nothing, I mean, it's always, I'm going to say probably since the 20s been like this.
Yeah, I don't know, man. It's so frustrating. It's like, all these people, the people who get their films made a lot of the times are not the best filmmakers, the people who have access to the money. So, yeah, if your parents and your relatives are loaded, mom, dad, can I have $500,000 to make my independent movie? Great, you're a filmmaker. But if your parents don't have $500,000 to give you, what do you do? You know?
Jeremy, it's not only that.
Yeah.
Forget the rich parents. It's connections.
Right.
You could be the richest. The Warner Brothers, their grandchildren could not get jobs at Warner Brothers.
Right.
Okay? They just couldn't. This is a true story. They were not allowed in the building.
Right.
Okay? But it is connections. But even if it doesn't matter how much money you have, I have to say it's just, it does come down to who you know in one sense, and also whose good side you're on.
Yeah. And there's a lot of luck involved.
It's all luck, I think.
I think like the material and the skills that you have, but unfortunately, it doesn't always work that way. So
you know, I find that I always talk about the 70s cinema and all that kind of stuff, but really, that was one of the only times, if not the only time, in the history of Hollywood, where someone truly could break out fresh because they were allowing everyone to make movies. I mean, they were at such a loss for what material people wanted to see. You know, they were bringing people, you know, you have an idea? Okay, great. You're a young guy. Go to it. You know, because they were so out of touch with their audience that they were looking everywhere they could.
Right.
You know, and I'm waiting for another renaissance like that, but I'm going to be waiting for a long, long time.
I think we're going to be waiting until the next Stone Age.
So, you know, and it's all sorts of false things you have to deal with. I don't know if you guys have you guys been in L.A.? Have you tried to do the whole L.A. dance at all?
Oh, yeah, I've done it. I had a brother who did it who almost blew his brains out, who was a screenwriter. So I know all about L.A. and its dark side, its underbelly.
It's a lot of, like, what happens is you call someone up and you tell them about your idea or your script, and they always go 99.99999% of the time, that is the greatest idea for a product I have ever heard of. Thank you so much for sending this material to me. And they're, like, exuberant and excited, and you send the material to them, and 6 years later, they've never read it. They've never even read the first paragraph.
No,
and I'm always confused. It's like, why are you so excited about the material when I tell you about it and I send it to you and you never bother to read, like, the first page? It's so bizarre. It's so twisted. The way that people interact with you is to always sound excited about what you're doing and then to never even look at it. It's so strange, you know. It's just like, it's sort of like, you know, Alice in Wonderland kind of thing. And it's just bizarre, but that's just me, you know.
Yeah.
So
well, back
I mean,
to
I
your book.
Yeah. Oh, about the book. Yeah. But we're talking about Hollywood. About the book.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, what else do you want to know about? Anything specific? Or
I'd like to know
what
your favorite shot is. I'd like to know what your favorite shot and your favorite sequence or scene is in a movie.
Favorite sequence or scene, the one that I can think of, honestly, you know, I don't know if you guys are into musicals. I love Moulin Rouge. I mean, some people like musicals, some people hate them. I understand if you don't like it. I think Moulin Rouge is a great movie. I love the way they shoot, like the tango dance, the rock.
No,
dance.
It's very innovative. It's
I
was blown. I didn't think I would like it. I saw notes. You know, I'm not. I before that, I can't say I was a big musical fan, but in my old age, I am warming up to musicals.
Right. Well, there's a scene also in Coen Brothers film. You familiar with The Big Lebowski?
Yes, I love that film.
When you have this character and he's bowling, and there's all sorts of cinematic things that are going on while he's bowling. It starts out in regular motion, and then he bowls, and it shows, like, I think it shows, like, a close-up of the pins going down, and then it goes to, like, slow motion as he dances, And like I said before, he lifts his finger up, and the camera pans up to his finger, and it spins around to the guys watching him. Or, like, it shows the guys watching him in slow motion and pans over them. They're like, oh, do we really have to watch this guy, you know? You can see the expressions on their faces, like, oh, come on, you know? And then there's all this fun stuff that is going on, you know? So, yeah, that'd be probably my favorite sequence that I can think of right off the bat. And,
yeah.
You know, I think the book is useful. Especially if you're just starting out and you want to know how these things, how does this work? Because when I was starting out, you know, I didn't know how it would work. I was starting from scratch. You know, I had to sort of learn everything from scratch. I was one of these kids that had been, you know, making short films as a 10-year-old. And, you know, I was like, oh, all I ever want to do is be a filmmaker. You know, I had to start at 20 or so and just start from scratch. And that's how I did it. And I hopefully it can be helpful to other people who are starting from scratch. And maybe the next edition I'll put some sort of magic symbol in there that brings, you know, pours money out of the pages so people can get their movies made. I haven't picked that one out yet.
I'll buy that one. Oh,
yeah,
definitely.
I'll buy that one too.
It's the revised second edition of Setting Up Your Shots, and it's available in stores now. And actually, it's on our homepage where all of our listeners are right now. If you click the cover of the book, it'll take you directly to purchase it.
Sure.
I think it's a very useful, valuable book. Don't listen to any of the criticism, man. And
with the criticism. Buy the book right now.
Buy 100 copies just in case. In case there's like a nuclear war and you need to, you know, use it for something. I don't know. Buy 100 copies.
Okay. Well, there you heard it right from the author, folks.
Right.
Jeremy, thank you so much for joining us today, man.
Thank you.
It's been a lot of fun.
Yes, thank you.
Bye.
Thank you, Jeremy. Bye-bye now. All right, that's Jeremy Vineyard.
Wow, you know what? Think about that now. His last name is Vineyard, and we had the director of the movie about the wine. This is a very wine-themed show tonight.
Yeah.
And
then Chris is about to call in, and he's going to be drunk. I mean, it all, like, ties in together.
Wait a second. Let me get my bottle of wine. Hold me. I don't want to be left out. Can I just say something about that last interview?
Please.
I've had 1,000 flashbacks right now.
You know, it's funny. I didn't think the interview would go that way. Like that. I was strictly, you know, about the book, and it's a joy when we go off, you know, script, so to speak.
Yeah.
Just let our minds kind of wander.
That was interesting.
You know, it is kind of a balancing act, this show, because we're celebrating the magic of movies, which automatically builds you up and, you know, yeah, I want to be part of it. And then we occasionally have the harsh doses of reality that we have to stick
in there,
too.
We got that immediately, though.
He was great.
He was awesome. He was telling it like it is, you know.
Mm.
Let's get Chris on.
Yeah, as soon as he calls, we will.
Okay.
He is on the phone. Okay. This is a great, exciting segment, and we invite everyone to call in because this might be a fun conversation. Don't be scared.
Call us.
And share with us your favorite shots and sequences for movies, because that's what we're about to talk about now with our good friend Chris. Hey, buddy.
What is up? What's going on, guys?
Hi, Chris. It's very good to hear your voice.
It is also good to hear your voice, Jerry.
Thank
you. How you doing?
Yeah. I'm doing good. We've had a most interesting night so far.
Really?
It's been something.
I didn't get to hear it, unfortunately, but I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. We've built the groundwork here talking about the book Setting Up Your Shots and how Hollywood sucks, and I think it's time for us to share. I thought it would be fun to share our favorite kind of not only shots, but
sequences
from films, our favorite visual directors and you know, stuff such as that. So anybody want to get the ball rolling? We all have ideas about this. Go ahead, either one of you.
Chris should go because he hasn't been on for a while. So
go ahead, buddy.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't mean that in a bad way. I just meant it because Chris, you know, he hasn't had the floor in a while.
No, I know what you meant, Jerry.
Okay.
You have the floor.
I did not take it as any sort of insult.
Okay.
All right. I thought since I'm going first, I guess I will choose one of my sequences, which is an opening, one of the best openings of all time, in my opinion, from the Coen brothers' Raising Arizona. The whole opening sequence, you know, there's no credits to the movie. it just sort of jumps into the H.I. McDonough character talking about the situation and how they can't have any kids. And you get this whole sequence of things that happens before you finally, like 15 minutes into the movie, you finally get the title screen, Raising Arizona. And, you know, it's got that great music behind it by Carter Burwell.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, that one, for me, that's one of the best opening sequences of all time. Kind of hard to narrow. I don't have a lot of favorite shots for movies, but there are sequences and
yeah, shots are difficult.
Scenes.
Yeah, shots
yeah.
are.
Yeah, but you're right. That I mean, it really sets the tone for the movie because right from the first second, you're off and running.
Yeah.
Can I hang up now?
Yeah.
I'm not gonna be able to top that. I mean,
and that music is great. It's so inspired. That music, whatever that hillbilly, you know, say, yeah, whatever. I can't sing it here and there, but. I
yeah. Well, no, yodel away, please. I
only yodel in the canyon. Okay, Jerry.
Okay, you know,
what do you got on your mind?
I don't think it's going to be as good as Chris's, but I'm going to pick one. And I agree with you, Chris. It is hard about shots. You know, I was thinking about that. I mean, there are shots. I mean, but I don't know if I can say why they're important to me. But I will pick. I'm going to pick a scene. From a movie, an end scene from a movie by a director that the three of us really love and that Jamie and I basically thought we could do the whole show about just the De Palma sequences. But my favorite sequence in the De Palma film is the end of Obsession, where they're running through the airport, and she runs up, and it's Cliff Robinson, and she goes, "Daddy." And I just love that. I'll never think of the words daddy in the same way ever again. And I think you all know what I'm talking about. I hope so.
Yeah.
If not, then I'm going to hang up in shame and humiliation.
Yeah. I don't have a damn clue what you're saying.
Oh, you son of a bitch. But I just love, it's like all these, and of course it gets, you know, it goes further as we get into more De Palma movies in that era. He goes, you know, further and further. But in that one, just the Bernard Herrmann music and the cutting back and forth, and just that the way it culminates in that daddy is just incredible.
Yeah, you know, and you're right. We can build a whole show on De Palma, which we have.
Yeah,
you know, the more popular ones, the examples of De Palma, and I know Obsession is very close to your heart, but you know, we got the Dress to Kill Museum, the kind of back and forth flirtation. And then 10 minutes later, we have the whole. She finds out that he has a venereal disease and runs to the elevator.
Yeah.
And she's on edge about that. And then the elevator door opens and she gets hacked up to death. He is the master of sequences because he is what we're discussing. He's not necessarily like Scorsese in that the camera is a character in the scene, an active character in the scene. It's just it's just built visually. You know, it's a visual experience. It's a completely visual experience.
Well, yeah. Well, Scorsese is a hack. He just makes remakes now. You know, I mean.
That's beautiful. That was the reference to our interview that we just did, Chris.
How dare you bring him up?
But you do bring up Scorsese, and I'm glad you brought him up because I just watched for the 100th time last week Casino, and I've never seen a better shot, a better looking film. I mean, just pristine, and the camera work it keeps you alert and on edge for 3 hours and 15 minutes, or however long the movie is, 2:50 or something. He is fantastic. Cape Fear, his camera work in Cape Fear, and what people don't understand is his camera work is motivated. I mean, it's motivated to elicit an emotional response, if not motivated with the themes and the characters in the actual scene. Everything is motivated in Cape Fear, especially. And to hear some of his commentaries on his DVDs, it's like a master class of that.
Mm-hmm.
So that's one that I would choose too. And definitely, I mean, the Coen brothers are masters at it too. In terms of favorite sequences, I have a favorite sequence, but it's not because it's not because of the bravado of the camera work. But it is a lot. It does have a lot to do with the visual style, the visual texture of the sequence, and what it means to the lead character, and that's Empire of the Sun. It's the all-time most moving sequence, most beautiful looking sequence for me in film. It's when young Jamie, he first enters the camp, and he walks away from the group and finds a field of Japanese aircraft.
Yeah.
And he dreams of being a pilot. I mean, it's like his great childhood dream. And he goes up to a plane, and it's magic hour, and sparks are flying all over the place where they're welding the plane or working on the plane, and he touches it, and it's just like a tactile moment for him that he's right up there with his dream, and three Japanese soldier pilots walk up behind him, and he turns, they salute him, and he salutes back, and the music crescendos. It's just a gorgeous moment, and actually that whole movie is driven by the sun and driven by the photography of the sun. I mean, just as a little side note, you've never seen such beautiful photography of the sun than in that film. You know, whether it's rising or setting. And Spielberg does that a lot. Spielberg does a lot of great sequences, and he has a lot of great shots of people looking out, a lot of great shots of people thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Where obviously the camera's still, or it's a very slow dolly, so very effectively and you're almost not aware of it because the camera's dialing in so slow, but you're getting inside of that thought process, you know, with those slow dolly ends that our guest was referring to earlier.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of is there classic Jerry? I know you mentioned the Wild Bunch.
Yes,
that being influential.
It is the Wild Bunch. I mean, one of my favorite sequences, and it's probably. Probably something I should never watch because its influence on me has been drastic and detrimental. But the shootout at the end, one of the most influential, and it's not because it's influential. It's because it is very raw. That with the slow motion, the standard what would become his standard slow motion violence,
right.
The shots. But the shootout at the end, when William Holden goes to Ernest Borgnine, they're in the bordello, and he goes to Ernest Borgnine, let's go. And I think that's the last words that William Holden says. With the exception of bitch when the girl shoots him during the shootout, but that's the last words he says, and they go to get their friend back, and it's, you know, one of the for me, that's one of the most incredible violent sequences in cinema.
Yeah.
Maybe more so than some of the earlier Kurosawa. Maybe. I'm not sure on that. At 37, I don't know yet to say that.
Well, it definitely changed things, and it changed the way that we view violence as an audience. I mean, Bonnie and Clyde did the same thing. It changed the way we view violence and the way violence is portrayed in the movies. And
mm-hmm.
You say that it's old hat now, the freeze frame and the slow motion. It was brand new. I mean, when he did it, it was laboring over. It almost made the violence poetic in a way.
Right.
With Peckinpah's technique in that. He has also. I do like his opening sequence. I know it's. Shat upon a lot for The Getaway.
Opening. Who shits on that?
A lot of people say that.
I'll find what Armand White. I'll find them. But that's a great opening sequence. Oh my god!
I love the sequence. Yeah, I do. When the character, when Steve McQueen character is introduced in the boredom and
mm-hmm.
the routine of his life and behind bars.
Yeah,
it's beautifully expressed. Do you have a classic movie that you look to, Chris? And think, wow, they really did it right there in terms of shots or sequences. Or...
I don't know. It's hard. How do we define classic? Is classic like Cars?
Yeah,
like 25 years? Is that how it's done?
No, let's rephrase that, Jamie. Classic is kind. We throw that term around so much. Why don't we just say our favorite instead of? Yeah, because classic, I think, is just so misunderstood.
That is a good question, though. I mean, the older we get, the fuzzier that determination becomes.
Yeah, I mean...
Before you're born.
Okay, well, before I'm born, all right, that's easy. I got one chambered from before I was born, and I know it's not one of your favorites, Jamie, but for me, once you've sat through the 3 hours of Stanley Kubrick's 2001... The big payoff, the big money shot after all this thinking you're doing of watching this movie is that beautiful Star Child that's
mm-hmm.
revealed at the very end of the movie with that incredible music just thundering through a great sound system.
Yeah.
That's one of those things that, like, a real payoff. I like a movie with a good payoff at the end, you know, like the shootout in Taxi Driver or the shootout in Unforgiven. Star Child at the end of 2001 is one of those for me. That's just, I feel like I'm paralyzed by the end of the movie. There's no way, like, someone could call me and say, "Hey, your mother's having a seizure on the porch right now," and I wouldn't get up because I gotta see the end of this movie. I've been dedicated for 3 hours now. I gotta do it.
Yeah.
So that's one that, like, every couple years, that moment when I look at the shelf, I'm like, "Oh, what do I want to watch?" When I run across that movie, that's what I have, an instant flash in my mind of, okay, you're going to sit there for 3 hours, but the payoff is going to be the Star Child. It's so great. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It is.
It's hard to argue with that, man. I mean, I agree.
Yeah.
Shots in movies, like you said, they're harder to come by, but I do have some favorite shots. There's the shot in Blue Velvet. I mean, it's hard to pick out a single shot from a Lynch film, but there's a scene, there's a, just frame it, because it looks like a masterpiece painting. Dennis Hopper standing next to Dean Stockwell when he's singing that song with the light illuminating his face from below.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that's hypnotic. I mean, that's, and a lot of times directors will sit down with their VPs and they'll look at, you know, paintings from the classic artists, you know, from different periods, and they'll say, "I want that look, I want that look," because a DP, they work with shadows and light, and they study the light and the colors in the painting and try to replicate that feel. And I'm sure Lynch does it. I mean, he's an artist on top of being a director, but just a beautiful, hallucinatory kind of image for Blue Velvet. So that would be a choice for my, one of my favorite shots. Citizen Kane, there's a shot, and I don't know the context of the scene. I forget, it's been a little while since I've rewatched it. It's in the set design mostly, but it's just a static shot, which, you're talking about movement. Orson Welles moved the camera in very innovative ways too, but this is a static shot where he's talking about business problems. He's in the foreground. In the background, you see the adjoining room with huge arch windows.
Right.
He walks from the foreground to the background, and as he walks into the background, I'm sorry, they're small windows. As he walks in the background, the windows appear larger and dwarf him. And that's why that movie's such a visual masterpiece, because it illuminates the characters and their situation and what's going on within them. The camera work just reiterates that. It's beautiful, beautiful filmmaking. Spike Lee, what do you guys think of his signature shot, which is that dolly move where the camera's in motion but the character is still? It's almost like it is that they're standing or sitting on a rolling dolly, and they're just moving the dolly, and so you see motion behind the movement behind them, but they're static. What do you think of that shot?
I get upset if I don't see it in one of his films.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah.
You wait for it. You kind of know in the back of your mind it's going to be there, and it usually is. And when it's used, he always finds a way to use it so that it's not just kind of, you know, it's appropriate when he uses it. He always finds a way to put it in there, even if it's just for a second.
It's never forced on the story. Like, I think it works beautifully in Clockers.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, very inventive. Hmm. In Clockers, when Harvey Keitel is telling the young kid, you know, who committed a crime, he's telling the young kid the story he needs to use to cover it up.
Right.
And he becomes a character in that story.
Mm-hmm.
As he's telling him, it's beautifully done. And also Malcolm X, when he walks to his assassination, you know, and he's kind of gives the appearance of he's kind of floating on air.
Yes.
Sometimes it seems arbitrary. I mean, there's a scene of Wesley Snipes and Spike Lee in Jungle Fever where they're having a conversation on the sidewalk, where they're supposed to be walking and they're kind of floating. It doesn't necessarily have any kind of relation to the scene itself. But most of the, you liked it in Inside Man, didn't you, Chris?
Yeah, I loved it in the Inside Man because, you know, the whole, when he's kind of in the trailer, and then I forget exactly what happens, but something happens, like they shoot somebody in the bank, or they give the illusion that they've shot somebody. And the shot is used to sort of illustrate the sort of, like, Denzel Washington's character has to get from there to the bank immediately, and all he's thinking about is what's happened, and is this his responsibility? And you can—it all is illustrated just by that sequence, you know. And he had he hadn't used it like that before, but he was able to work the shot in that time to explain a lot. I thought it was pretty cool.
Yeah. We got some, you know, I'm just reviewing as far as I can up there from the chat room. Stand By Me, When the Kids Are Chased by the Train. Tim likes that. Nomadius says, Scene in Schindler's List with the Girl in the Red Jacket. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm,
Fugitive,
yeah.
When Harrison Ford was dangling above the waterfall. These are action sequences that Tim likes. The
I have a shot that I like.
Malcolm McDowell in Clockwork Orange. I don't know what scene he's referring to, but
and then probably the opening when we first see him when they're sitting at the Cordova Milk Bar, I think.
Right.
And the camera
and
zooms
a slow dolly into his.
Yeah.
What were you thinking?
Well, there's a scene. We used to joke that this was the only reason this director made this movie, but Michael Cimino's Year of the Dragon, when Tracy Zhu wakes up in the morning and you have that beautiful skyline dawn shot of New York City from her penthouse apartment, beautiful penthouse apartment, and it's just like right at dawn, and it's her silhouette and then the city, and it's a beautiful shot.
Speaking of which, how about Heat? How about that De Niro's apartment, like, slathered in that blue,
mm-hmm.
and he's standing at his picture window overlooking the ocean.
That's right.
Michael Mann is another one that's just atmosphere and tactile feeling and such bold use of color. And,
right.
Much like Spike Lee, I mean, I'm thinking of 25th Hour near the beginning when they're all walking to the club, you know, he
mm-hmm.
and Philip Seymour Hoffman and Anna Paquin. They're walking across the street, and all of a sudden they get near the club, and they are illuminated in the most such a robust kind of blue, I think it's a blue color,
mm-hmm.
That just, like, saturates the screen. And in terms of color, Spike Lee is bold in his choices of color. That's part of the passion that I'm talking about with this man. I mean, he really expresses a lot with the use of color, blues, and then in the club, the reds, and all the different kind of colors that he uses in that film, and the saturation of He Got Game. You know, it's hard to describe He Got Game, the look of it, but it has a very special look to it. And, you know, obviously somebody mentioned Carrie in the chat room, and you can't mention Carrie without talking about The Prom.
Yeah.
the prom sequence. Do you have a favorite De Palma sequence, Chris?
If I had to pick, I like the showy De Palma sequences, like you were talking about earlier, Jerry's scene from Obsession and the other one from Dressed to Kill. But my two favorites, just for sentimental reasons, used to be two favorite movies of my in my family, are the two baby carriage sequences, the one at the end of Raising Kane and the one at the climax of The Untouchables.
Yeah.
Very, very similar sequences, and even have the similar, you know, focal point of the scene is this baby carriage. You know, it's just human nature, like, oh my God, a baby might be shot or stabbed or killed or something like that. It's a pretty simple little trick that he's playing on the audience. But he does it so effectively in both movies. He makes real good use of slow motion and music music in Raising Kane, not so much in Untouchables.
Right.
But, both really classic De Palma shots. But his movies have no shortage of moments like that. That's why I was kind of trying to put together some movies, some scenes here. You know, there's so many. Any of my movies in my collection, you know, they have moments. But I'm trying to think of.
Mm-hmm.
A movie that you look at it and you think of that moment as soon as you hear the title of the movie. And I got another one, actually, that I got to mention before we're done on this show. Talking about tension and setting a mood. Boogie Nights. Alfred Molina's house in Boogie Nights. Dirk and John C. Reilly going to score the coke at Alfred Molina's house.
Oh, yeah. The firecrackers, the kid with the firecrackers, I mean.
How fucking nuts does that scene make you when you watch it? I mean, it just goes on forever, and it's so tense. I'd say probably on the list of, like, in terms of tension, there's moments in movies with tension, but, like, tension that lasts the longest in a scene.
You want to rip
that
your hair
probably,
out.
That one's probably got it. Like, that's a good 10 minutes of level 10 tension.
Oh yeah,
and it's accented by that really long shot of Mark Wahlberg,
Yeah, there's
sitting
a show
there. He's dazed. The engines are turning. I think it's the best performance he's given. That one shot.
Oh, yeah.
And it holds such a long time, and then he has kind of a smile on his face, and you know it's you know another thinking shot. There's power in that, you know, just to stay on the actor as they're thinking. They don't necessarily have to be saying anything. You know, that's enough to grasp an audience if the actor's good.
Mm-hmm. And it tells you what a talented guy Anderson is too, because it's hard to believe if you go back and watch that movie. It was his second film.
Yeah,
amazing. Second film with Boogie Nights.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah.
Pretty.
And it starts right at the beginning from that long opening shot. That long, unbroken shot into the club following the characters table by table. Scorsese has something similar in Goodfellas. That's something that's very touted when they introduce all the colorful gangster characters in the bar, restaurant there. Touch of Evil is touted a lot. That opening shot that really pans from, like, the rooftops of buildings onto the street. It crescendos with the exploding car and just bravura of filmmaking.
And also, like, another De Palma, the best part of Snake Eyes is that opening tracking shot.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And the tracking shots, as someone mentioned it in the chat room earlier, you know, the famous tracking shot from Atonement and also the one from Children of Men recently. These are two movies in the last 2 years that just beautiful sequences. Absolutely beautiful sequences.
Chris mentioned Raisin Kane.
Yeah,
how about that shot where they go upstairs in the police station and view the body or something, and it actually goes up, you know, a full two flights of stairs, down the hall, into the elevator, out of the elevator, how the hell do you do that? And these are performed by absolutely precise technicians. And to keep focus, you know,
shaky hands.
Right down to the focus puller. I mean, to keep everything in focus and it's just beautiful camera work. I would think it would be a cameraman's dream to work with De Palma.
I would think so. I mean, each film, even the lesser films, there's always a great tracking shot. Always.
Yeah. Yeah. There's an opening sequence of Last Tango that I really like, where it starts like above Brando. It's the very first image of the movie, above Brando, and zooms into him as he looks up to the heavens with his hands grasping the sides of his head, and he shouts a really awful obscenity. But it really goes to show you automatically know what state of mind that character's in the first frame. And the whole movie is shot like, it really is, there are moments that are shot like a tango. Like when he is in the apartment and she shows up in the apartment and the camera's kind of low to the ground and it's just kind of dancing around them and between them and navigating around those two characters. It's another beautifully shot movie for me. We have a couple of minutes left. If anybody wants to call in and share your thoughts on this subject, the number to dial is 718-508-9477. Don't be shy. I know you guys are all speaking up in the chat room, but we'd like to hear you here and get another conversation going.
Right.
I got
shots
another one, actually.
Yeah,
I got one, buddy. Chris.
Go, guys.
Lesser movie. The movie does not fit in with things like Last Tango and, you know, Obsession and these kind of movies, what we're talking about, but the scene is a diamond. American Werewolf in London, the transformation scene. I know this is a scene that gets played a lot, and you hear about it a lot. You hear about that scene more than you hear about the movie, and there's a reason, because the movie's not that great. I like it for sentimental reasons, but it's not a masterpiece, you know? But that scene is not only... If that comes on TV, if you're flipping channels, I do not believe you can pass by it. You got to watch that scene, you know?
Right.
And it's also kind of a really great argument. I have no problem with CGI, but it's an argument that CGI is not necessary because there's no transformation to werewolf or vampire or any other creature that's been quite as effective as that one, and it was all done practically.
Yeah.
So
it's more wondrous that way.
Yeah.
It's more wondrous that way. You know, you're not looking at it and saying, hey, look what that computer did.
Yeah, exactly.
Uh-huh.
And I do like that movie, and I think maybe because, like you said, sentimental, but that movie grows on me each time I see it. And maybe the very reason you said, because of the no CGI.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really feels like, it feels very organic, which is something a lot of CGI can't do. It's been done, CGI has been done, and it's been made to feel organic. I'm talking about things like Gollum, or even some of the dinosaur effects in Jurassic Park.
The first Jurassic Park, yeah.
Yeah, but that, it's never, even that is not quite as organic as that transformation in American Werewolf in London.
No, of course
impossible,
not.
Impossible to turn away from.
And that awful makeup job, or the, it's a terrific makeup job, but it just looks awful. Griffin Dunn coming back with his neck all torn out.
Oh, yeah.
Man. Jerry, what did you have in mind?
I like a sequence in a movie, a Korean movie called Old Boy, and I think you guys know what I'm going to say.
That's a great corridor sequence.
Because it's not, you know, I heard, you know, I read so much about this movie over the years, and when it finally came to theaters, you know, you think you have an idea of what the scene is going to look like.
Yeah.
And it wasn't at all, and the way it was shot, just was, it was classic, instantly, and it was, you know, very raw, but I just love the way it was all, the way it was shot, the way it's almost claustrophobic in some ways, but it's just beautiful, absolutely.
That's a great film. Talk about a payoff ending, man.
Yeah, oh my.
I'm one of those guys that don't try to figure things out as I'm watching a movie, you know, I just let it happen to me, so it has to be really bad for me to figure out a surprise ending, but... the ending of that movie blew me away.
Yeah.
I felt just like the character, you know, completely like, you know, what the hell?
Yep.
Great movie. And when he's eating the squid or the octopus or something in
there. The octopus. I want to say octopus.
The opening sequence in 8.5 is the closest to the feel of a dream that I've ever seen in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Where it's filled with all of these awkward, odd, but beautifully strange faces. And he kind of levitates out of his car, and then the next shot, he's in the middle of the sky, and a boy has his foot hanging by string, and he's in midair, almost like he's a balloon or a kite or something, and he falls. And I think that everyone's had a dream like this where you're falling off a cliff or falling off something, and you feel it as you're sleeping in the pit of your stomach.
Yeah.
That's the feeling of that opening scene. It's an amazing sequence.
Oh, dude, Fellini, a lot of Fellini films with that one especially. You're absolutely right.
Yeah, and you know, there's parts of Cries and Whispers that you could frame. I mean, so aesthetically pleasing. There's one shot in Scarface. I know everybody talks about the chainsaw sequence, but one shot in Scarface where they're storming his mansion at the end of it. The man comes in and shoots his sister.
Yeah.
You know, and he takes him and flips him off the balcony, and he falls in the swimming pool. And then he stands on the balcony, and he's shooting the machine gun down at his body in the pool.
Yeah.
There's one shot, it lasts 2 seconds, of him standing on that balcony with the machine gun that I think is so striking. Yeah, it's a static shot that only lasts for 2 seconds, but it is for me the baddest ass shot in that whole movie.
No, it's a you're absolutely right. It is.
Yeah, I love that moment. I love that moment.
There's also shots that they're never quite as effective as the first time you saw them. That doesn't mean they're not good still. They're just not quite as effective. I'm thinking about sequences like in The Silence of the Lambs at the end of the movie with the doorbell ringing switch. You know what I'm talking about?
Where
you think Jodie Foster is at the wrong house and you think Scott Glenn is at the right house, and it's actually reversed. There's moments like that in movies that you never can recreate what it was like the first time you saw that and you said to yourself or whoever you were sitting with, oh, shit, she's at the right house. You know, like you can't ever recreate that. Or like the scene in The Matrix when he first takes the pill and goes down the rabbit hole and wakes up in this, like, post-apocalyptic world with these giant robots eating people.
Yeah.
The first time you saw it, it was like, what the hell is going on, you know? Now it's still a good shot. It's still a good sequence.
Yeah.
Just like Silence of the Lambs, but it's never going to be like the first time you saw it.
No,
well, they rely on the element of surprise, and that's gone.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Seven. I mean, you could frame any shot in Seven.
Oh, any Fincher film. I mean,
in particular, there's a shot or scene in that movie that was completely accidental, and it's when they had a tip on where this guy lives, and they're going to storm the apartment, and they walk up, and it's the guy that he kept alive for a year, and he's covered in bed sores, and he's the victim I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But they're on the way there, and they're talking about whether or not they've ever fired a gun. And Brad Pitt talks about his partner got shot and killed or something, and he was trying to remember his name, and he couldn't. And then it cuts to Morgan Freeman, and Morgan Freeman has a pained expression on his face because that's the sadness of this job and this life.
Mm-hmm.
But when it cuts to Morgan Freeman, there's just a blast of sunlight shooting through the taxi window or the police car windows. And it just does something for that scene. It's almost transcendent or ethereal somehow.
Mm-hmm.
And Fincher said, God bless the gods, because that was a complete accident. It's just one of those magical moments in a movie, if you're looking out for it. That really gets to me every time, and I look forward to seeing it each time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
You're right. Fincher is pretty incredible. I mean, you can basically frame any still from his movie.
You definitely can.
Yeah. Fun conversation, guys. Anything else in mind?
Oh, I could go on. I think Chris said, well, all three of us could go on all night.
Yeah, it's easy to just keep talking about it, but those are the big ones. Those are the ones that jump to my mind, and I'm sure you guys' minds.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Well, that's all the time we have. We appreciate all the listener calls tonight.
Yes, thanks for calling in, everyone.
Yeah, thank you, guys. But really, we appreciate you being in the chat room and listening in tonight. And we'll be back Wednesday night, I think. Wednesday night's just going to be a relaxed show, unless we can get Brian Cox. Which we might do. We might have a pre-recorded interview with him tomorrow if we can work it out. If not, then we'll just be back and we'll talk about some great fun stuff with you guys. 10 o'clock Wednesday. We'll see you then. Guys, thanks for taking part, and have a good one.
Have a good one, too. Right,
bye, guys. Are you a filmmaker looking for a great score for your next movie? Well, look no further than Michael McCormick, the composer whose works you hear at the opening and the closing of every episode of Movie Geeks United. This is a phenomenal talent, and you can hear more samples of his work at michaelmccormickmusic.com or on his MySpace page, which you can access through the Movie Geeks United Top Friends.